This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi, everyone. You're looking fabulous. Just fabulous. And I'm sure it's all extremely ethically sourced. It's very nice to have you here at the Wheeler Centre for this question time. We've had a hiatus of a couple of months, so we're now back. If you haven't been here before, this is a series that we run monthly at the Wheeler Centre where we pick an interesting topic and we get lots of really interesting people to come and answer questions from you. And tonight we're talking about fast fashion. So it's Melbourne Fashion Week. A lot of us think about what we wear, I'm sure. We didn't just, you know, come out, oh, well, actually, this what I'm wearing is was the only thing that didn't need ironing, to be quite honest. That might be some of your criteria, and that's absolutely fine. But what we look at is incredibly, what we look like is incredibly important. I would wager that many of you in this room have bought clothes at least monthly, twice monthly this year. I would also wager that many of you would have cupboards that are at least half full of stuff that is actually just destined for Vinnies. And that is not an accident. That is an accumulation of patterns and marketing by the fashion industry over the last couple of decades in particular, and what's become to be known as fast fashion. So when we talk about fast fashion, we mean literally fast. So pieces these days can go literally from design to manufacturer to on our racks in the high street in 1 week. And that is absolutely phenomenal. That drives desire, that drives consumer behaviour, but that also drives lots of other stuff. And that includes very questionable ethical practices to do with the environment, to do with work conditions in developing countries. Of course, it was the Rana Plaza collapse in 2013 in Bangladesh, where over 1,000 garment workers lost their lives. It really woke probably a lot of us up to the reality of manufacture of fast fashion. But there are also incredible environmental costs, and our panel will be able to talk about that tonight. But to give you some idea, the clothing industry is the second most polluting industry in the world after oil. So the fashion industry is starting to wake up to this and to implement some new guidelines and sort of self-regulation about it. Is it happening fast enough? And do they really mean it while they're still trying to sell us clothes, new items every week, while they're getting new stuff into their collections every week? So that's some of the stuff that you might want to talk about with our panel tonight. Question time runs is this is your hour. So this is not a panel discussion. This is your opportunity to ask as many questions as you can get in of the assembled experts here this evening. We have two ushers and they'll come around with a microphone, and we will conclude at 7:15. So my tip to you is to not be shy and to get your questions in early, because what always happens is there are always too many questions at the end and some people go away disappointed. So I'm Madeline Morris. I should introduce myself. My full-time job is I'm a reporter for 7:30 on the ABC. I'm currently on maternity leave, which is why I don't have anything that's ironed in my wardrobe. And I'll introduce the rest of the panel. So Jessica Perrin is the co-founder of the Not My Style app, which is a British-based app, but she'll be able to tell you a little bit more about it. It rates transparency of fashion labels and their working conditions, and she's worked in the development area for over a decade all across the world. Rebecca Hart is the CEO of Suzanne, and we thank you very much for being here and stumping up, because you're probably going to get most of the difficult questions this evening. So well done for coming. Dr. Clara Vuletic is a sustainable fashion consultant, and she has worked with H&M, David Jones and many others. She's also recently back from London, so is Jess, relatively recently. And Claire Press is Marie-Claire's fashion editor-at-large, and she is the author of Wardrobe Crisis, How We Went From Sunday Best to Fast Fashion, and she also presents the podcast Wardrobe Crisis. You don't look like you're having a wardrobe crisis. You're looking very good. And her book will be on sale later on tonight, and she's very happy to sign copies. So I just want to ask a question of each of you to sort of get the ball rolling. Clara, I'll start with you. So how big was the Rana Plaza collapse in sort of changing how everyone thinks about fast fashion? And what changes have you seen in the decade or so that you've been working in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, well, it was huge that, you know, what happened in 2013 with over 1,000 people.
Just get you
losing
to pull the mic just a wee bit closer to yourself.
2013, yes, with over 1,000 people losing their lives in Bangladesh. I mean, I guess from my personal point of view, it came a little bit too late in some ways. I mean, I got into this in London. I trained as a printer textile designer after leaving Australia. And, you know, in the sort of mid-2000s, 2005, 6, as a graduate or even in my sort of my degree while I was studying textile design, I guess I really started to investigate what was going on, and it came from a very personal point of view of actually learning to print and dye textiles. And I realised that the environmental impacts were huge, just literally for me to dye some textiles. I was getting, you know, real chemical reactions, and there was so much stuff going down the sink. So I had this kind of real epiphany of, you know, if this is what's happening at a very craft level, what's happening at a global level with the textile industry? And then I did a lot of reading and started going to a lot of conferences. But what I really began to see was you had these, you know, two huge different sectors. You had the fashion industry, which was this, you know, huge behemoth. And then you had, at that point, a lot of, you know, bit players. You had a lot of people who are from the NGO sector who were starting to really raise awareness. You know, I remember going to these conferences in London around sort of ethical textiles, and you had the guy who was from Pesticide Action Network, who was, you know, some guy who'd worked in Africa with cotton farmers, and he was there literally, you know, with these kind of thongs on. And these were all kind of people on the edges of society. And I remember really realising we were never going to get these people to talk to the fashion industry. And obviously I'd also been in the fashion industry working and come outside and gone into education, and even all the industry conferences, nobody was talking about this. So, but, you know, over time, then you started to get, I think 2011, you had a Greenpeace report about the toxic impacts in China from textiles. So there was then a growing kind of awareness, particularly around environmental impacts. And what also happened was a lot of the sportswear brands like Adidas and Nike, I think what people don't realise is they were the ones who were really starting to make changes, primarily because their customer was, you know, into the outdoor lifestyle, and in some ways their brand ethics were around, you know, making environmental improvements. So they also have always been innovative with material. So they started to innovate around sustainability and make, you know, choose better fabrics, really innovate around bamboo and sort of a sustainable material. So the sort of it was happening a lot in the sportswear and outdoor industry, and it was still not happening with fast fashion. But we've now seen probably in the last 4 to 5 years, you know, H&M are typically always talked about as the fast fashion brand who have finally realised, and they've woken up, and they're starting a kind of a strategy that that's really starting to pioneer things in terms of the mass market.
Is that your view as well, Claire? Do you think that the world is starting to wake up, has woken up? I mean, how would you rate?
Slowly crawling out of a slumber.
Right.
And listening to Clara there, I'm going, yeah, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that disconnect that operated back when you were seeing the Pesticide Action Network being ignored by big fashion. Big fashion is still generally, I think, ignoring this conversation to an extent. Rana Plaza was we often talk about it as the disaster that had to happen, like a watershed moment that you couldn't ignore, because if you know that an industry that you either work in and love or admire or just simply buy from is even possibly culpable in a story of the death of 1,134 people, you're going to have, it's a wake-up call, you're going to think. But the broader conversation is still in its early stages,
because
I think.
The key word there is know, if you know. And do you think that many people don't know?
Yes.
Or is ignorance bliss? We don't want to know.
That's such an interesting question. I think it's both. I talk a lot to students and younger people, and it's very surprising to me when I do come across young women in particular, but of all genders, but particularly younger women who love to buy new clothes on the weekend or love to shop in fast fashion shops, there's a lot of them who don't know about the issues that underpin this industry. I think the message still isn't getting out there. I think we do need to keep telling it. And sometimes I feel like a broken record, like, who made your clothes, where, how, and from what, which is the battle cry of Fashion Revolution, which is a campaign that began after Rana Plaza, a global non-for-profit campaign designed to raise awareness. I feel like I say it a lot and it's boring, but actually it falls on new ears often. So I think we've still got a long way to go. And the other thing I'd say is I think it can be an opportunity, I'll try and look at this from a positive perspective, otherwise people, like you say, don't want to know. So I don't know what everyone else thinks about that.
So Rebecca, I mean, Suzanne, you are a major high street brand in Australia. Mm-hmm. You got a B by the Baptist, from the Baptist World Care report, which I think it came out last year into working conditions, which is not bad. Mm-hmm. So tell us about what you do as a brand to ensure sustainable fashion and also good ethical standards in your production line.
Yeah, look, I think it's... as a retailer, we actually need to be quite accountable for actually going out. We actually are the ones that do interact with our supply chain and our factories. And I took on this role about 4 years ago in our business. And so it was I'd come from the retail side where I used to sell and out in stores and, you know, had all that great fun with buying clothes and selling clothes to customers. But when I took on the CEO role and just going out and meeting our vendors, it's really important that we actually take accountability for that as a brand. Because, you know, I think to the girl's point, it is really hard for customers to understand. It was such an eye-opener for me going up to China and really understanding that whole process. And, you know,
at the end of... Oh my God, what are we doing type way?
Or? No, actually really positive. You know, up in China, China's one of the most expensive. Outside of, you know, countries such as Australia and America and the UK, it's one of the most expensive countries now to produce in, and we still do produce a lot of our product up in China. But the factories are actually, or the factories we deal with in particular, are actually highly mechanised. We're actually quite innovative. But it is really important you have long-standing relationships with those factories as well, because they're not going to innovate and they're not going to try and actually look after their workers and actually provide really good conditions if you don't actually support them in the long term. So I do think it's a bit of a two-way street. And it is really important to get up and listen to the factory managers and the owners and understand what their challenges are. And a lot of the factories up there also provide, you know, housing conditions and living conditions for their factory workers for quite a period of the year. So for us, it is really important to really make sure that we're getting up and seeing those factories, seeing the workers and making sure we're making the right decision.
And how much pressure do you feel from consumers to be doing that? Or is this driven... Are you trying to lead first and the consumers will follow, or has it been the reverse?
Yeah, I think we've sort of always felt really, it's been really important to us as a brand to have a really ethical focus on our sourcing. And I think we do, as I said, we've got factories we have worked with for 30 years. So, but it's we've gone on, I guess, a journey with those factories and really understanding what it is that have been their challenges along the way. The Chinese government's also taking a massive focus in relation to pollution. They're closing and, you know, they're actually closing dye houses and those sorts of places, just mandatory to actually make sure that those environmental issues are actually improving. But that also creates other issues as well. And you need to be really supportive as a retailer of your factories and your mills and making sure that you're actually understanding what they're going through and then still being supportive. But for us, I guess we have customers who want a great quality product from us. They want really good fabrication, such as 100% linen. So for us, it's about making sure we are working with the right factories. Our customers are more for not so much fast fashion. They do like things with a fashion component and need to be relevant and still right for today's market. But really, it's about making sure we have that quality piece as well. So I think for us, it's making sure we have those factories that can actually deliver on those garments for our customers.
Okay. So, Jess, you're more at the consumer end, I suppose, and the technological ways that we're actually seeing innovation coming to answer some of these questions that
we're trying.
That we have. So tell us about Not My Style and that's its genesis and what you're actually how it works.
So Not My Style, for those who haven't heard of it, and a lot of you probably haven't because it's largely UK based. So it's an app that you can download on your iPhone from the Apple Store, and it tells you on your GPS map, when you're out shopping, on Swanston Street, on Oxford Street in London, which shops are around you and how they have been rated in terms of how transparent they are about their supply chain. I have done the ratings with my co-founders and a number of other volunteers, and we give a red, amber, green. Red, stop. Amber, think. Green, shop. It's a very simple rating made by me for you guys. We don't profess to be experts in fast fashion. In fact, I don't profess to be an expert in fashion by any means, but I am someone who, funnily enough, likes to wear clothes. And I want to make sure that when I'm buying my clothes, I know where they came from. And the kind of impetus, I guess, for Not My Style and where it came from is it's quite nice, actually, because I was you guys in an audience speaking to a panel about ethical fashion and supply chains. And me and my co-founder, one of the co-founders, were sitting next to each other, and there were some big brands on this stage and there were some really powerful voices who were working in the ethical fashion space. And we stood up and said, it's all very well and good. We know people are doing good things. Like, that's great. We're happy to see it moving forward. Can you just tell us where we can buy clothes? Like, just give me a couple of brands. Throw them at me. I want to know. Silence. And so that from that moment, that's where Not My Style was born. We named Not My Style about 10 minutes after that conversation, whispering to each other in the seat, where we were like, we have to change this and we have to do something.
What year was that, sorry?
End of 2014. Oh, okay. So we crafted the idea, we got another co-founder on board, and in 2015 we launched a crowdfunding app and we raised £25,000 to build what is Not My Style. It launched this year in the App Store after many long sleepless nights, millions of ratings. We wanted to be really fair, we wanted to be transparent, and more importantly, we wanted you to be able to do the rating as well. So we've rated over 100 high street brands, but you can also take the rating off our website, have a look at it on the app, and do it for brands that we haven't done, or you can ask us to do it for you. So the idea for us was just to put the information in consumers' hands while they're out walking down the street and thinking, oh gosh, I've got that meeting tomorrow, I'm going to need something new that I'm going to wear, or I've got that party on Saturday night. Decisions are made on the impulse with fashion so often, so we wanted to be there with you, which is why it's GPS located. So you can kind of like pop it up and it's going to be like, H&M's over there, they're a green in Not My Style. Whatever other shop is over there, and you can see around you where you can go. Nice, quick and easy. That
and
was the
what's,
point.
And what's been the feedback? Has it actually changed consumer patterns?
So that's what we're starting to
learn.
I mean,
not on a growth, you wouldn't expect it like on a mega scale, but from the feedback of...
That's our ultimate goal, is that we start to see consumers changing the way they behave. And I think we're realists as well. We did not come to this to see everybody buying completely only ethical. It's not realistic and it's not going to happen. But more thinking consciously about who they're buying from and actually feeling comfortable to go into Zara and say, hey, do you know where this was made and what are your supply chain practices? Because we want to see those conversations happening more and more. So the research is not in yet. We can't test the data to see how that's happening, but that's something that's our long-term goal.
Okay. Did we have any questions to start off with? Fantastic. So why don't we start that one in the middle, and then there's up this one up the front. Thanks.
Should I stand up?
Yes, please. We're just going to check out what you're wearing.
Yeah. I should have thought more this morning. You said that H&M got a green, so you can go ahead and shop. My question is H&M's business model really, really going to work with ethical production? Because essentially they work on the basis of low prices and not particularly great quality materials and frequent turnover. So how does that really work with ethical fashion?
That's a great question. You've worked with H&M, Clara. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the elephant in the room for me, which, you know, I know when I went into my engagement with them, it was I had heard a rumour about them wanting to double their profits in 5 years. So, you know, it's like, how's that going to fit with this? I wouldn't dare to obviously speak for them, but clearly as a model, that's there's a huge challenge here. What I can say is that from what I'm seeing that they're investing in and focusing on, I'm imagining what they're visioning for the future is what they're calling a closed loop textile system. So we talk a lot in the research I've done around this idea that there's slow and fast rhythms in fashion. So, you know, not not everyone is fast fashion. Obviously, there's different sectors and there's different types of brands who have different, you know, they bring out certain amounts of collections per year. And H&M, I think, are aiming to essentially create a kind of model where the clothes are designed and produced and brought to the shop, as you said, within a few weeks. They're designed to be bought a lot and to be maybe worn for a very short amount of time. But what they're trying to do possibly is to encourage the consumer for us to bring back the garments to the shop.
So that's what the closed loop means, does it?
Yes. So this is what I'm imagining they're doing, because this is where the future innovation's happening. It's in this idea of closed loop textiles. So the customer brings back the garment, and H&M have got bins in their shops currently, I think, in Australia. I know in Sweden and the UK. And
you can bring back garments that are not from
H&M.
You can basically use them as recycling bins for your garments.
What do they then do with that?
So, yeah, they've got a plan to be able to completely chemically recycle all these garments down and re-spin yarn and then make clothes from 100% recycled garments, textiles.
And we as retailers can source fabrications now that are fully recycled.
So in some ways there's this idea that maybe the fast fashion, maybe as a model it's fine, but if we can completely recycle and it keeps going around in this closed loop.
But does that not have environmental impacts in and of itself? I mean, you know, that's a huge energy consumer, what you're saying there, and to re-dye stuff, I mean,
less.
It's from an energy perspective, there's less carbon emissions from using recycled materials. It's definitely better.
There's a guy, H&M, I mean, as exactly as Clara says, the elephant in the room is overproduction, but they do pour money into R&D, into this idea of closing the loop.
Yes.
I'm going to talk about Denim on Denim because it's rad and it's Australian,
it's
which
so
I
cool.
love.
I know.
So they have
in Swinburne, here in Melbourne, you've got... Yeah. No, you
go for it.
Yeah.
You go for it, Claire.
But just H&M have this thing called the Global Change Award, I think it's called. I just wrote about it. I should know.
Yeah.
But what they do is they select from various contenders these scientific-based innovations that might be able to solve this problem of closing the loop. And one of the five finalists for this year's award was the Frontier...
They're called the Centre for Frontier Materials at Swinburne, which is such a cool name.
But Clara, say what they do, because it's actually amazing.
Well, I actually think I understand it. They're re-dyeing denim using old denim.
Fine powder. They pulverise them into like fine powder, which can then be fired using an inkjet printery thing. That's technological. Check with the Deacon as to exactly how you describe that. But then it basically becomes the pigment, so you can dye undyed denim with old denim.
Recolouring. Okay. So they're recolouring.
That's a true fully closed loop in that case.
It could be,
It could be, okay. So how far away is that sort of, just to finish your question and sort of take it to its logical end, how far away is that from being a reality in H&M?
Well, I mean, in theory it's great, but I think it's 5 to 10 years. Because you've got, when you think about, they've got... All their garments will be made from all different kind of specs. You know, you'll have poly cotton mixes, you'll have some linen, so you'll have some denim cotton. So all of those require these chemical recycling processes.
Just a quick question. Is it better for the environment to buy cotton and linen than polyester, or what would you say?
It's so complex.
There's no easy answer to the question.
Depends how the garment's going to be used and what you can do with it at the end.
But recycling is easier... For the natural fibres, correct?
No. This is the irony. Polyester is the one fibre at the moment we can completely recycle.
Yep.
And we can buy recycled polyester.
Right.
Great factory called Teijin in Japan.
Okay.
So the blends are the things that are challenge, have been the challenge, and the cotton and the linen's the challenge. But we're seeing a Swedish company who are about to be able to recycle cotton so that it's recycled and respun to a quality that we as fashion consumers want to wear, because at the moment, when you have recycled cotton, it's all lumpy and terrible.
Okay, so that was a slightly tangential question of mine, but one that I hope will be useful. Yes, the next question, thanks.
We hear a lot these days about things like slow food, slow travel. I'd like to maybe hear your thoughts of the panelists on slow fashion. And another thing is, there was a time when, in a country like Australia, most clothing was manufactured here. And it's been outsourced to developing countries, China, Bangladesh, obviously because it's cheaper. But what that means is that we're transporting a lot of clothing, textiles across the globe, maybe sometimes by ship, but probably a lot of times by plane. That results in a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. So how do we get around some of those issues? Do we need to start going back to manufacturing or producing clothing here and letting other countries produce their own clothing?
Rebecca, that's one for you.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said, we choose to manufacture in China because it does deliver an exceptional quality of garment. The reality, too, is a lot of the fabric mills are actually based in China. So even where companies move to other markets which have cheaper wages, you're still getting a lot of your fabrications made in China, and 30% of a garment cost actually is the fabrication in general that goes into a garment. So the reality, I think, in terms of if we were producing goods in Australia, for example, the price would be a lot higher. So I guess a lot of retailers are driven by price and that, and the price that the consumer is willing to pay. So there's no doubt, as you say, there is, I think, definitely in some areas, a slow fashion component starting to surface. And I think for, you know, for us, as I said, our customer certainly isn't about that fast fashion, but there is absolutely brands out there where customers are definitely driving that. Again, you know, we have made a choice to send all of our garments on ship and not plane. But again, that comes down to the fact that we can, because we're not needing to have garments in stores in 7 days. Our customer completely, you know, likes to come in and shop every couple of months, and she likes to see something new, but she's not driven by that latest and greatest. So
how long does a ship take?
The ship only takes about 10 days to come out of Shanghai. We actually deliver into Sydney, is where our warehouse is, so that actually takes about 10 days. So if you're planned and well organised, there is absolutely no reason why you would need to air things. But you're right, a lot of companies do air, and that is just because they want things out here in a very short turnaround of time.
I don't know if you can answer this question, but backstage we were saying that your sort of entry-level T-shirt retails for about $25.
Yeah.
If you were to produce that same T-shirt in Australia with Australian cotton, milled in Australia, fabricated in Australia, how much would you need to charge for that to make a similar margin?
We would be close up to $60, $70 retail. Okay. No doubt.
And would, and your consumers presumably wouldn't pay $60 for a T-shirt?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
I'll give you guys an example. So has anyone here heard of the brand Everlane?
Yes.
It's my favourite brand, and I am wearing Everlane tonight, and I want to give you a pricing example. So this T-shirt is from Everlane. So for those of you who aren't familiar with them, they're a Californian-based company, and they're doing kind of a thing they like to call radical transparency. And this is why it is radical transparency. This T-shirt was made in a factory in Ho Chi Minh City. You can go on their website and see interviews with the garment factory workers. It costs $45 US. Of that $45 US, $4.06 went into making this thing. $8.50 went into buying the materials. $2.50 in customs and $3 or something in shipping and logistics. That is transparency. And that is really, when you think about it, $4 to make this T-shirt, that is low. That is really low. And this is for a company that is actually working really closely with factories and trying to make things very ethical and give their factory workers a decent wage. So $4 on a $45 T-shirt, it's something to think about when you're going down the path of, well, you know, how much does it actually cost to make things? And I dare say that we can't compare this to any other brand, because I don't know any other brand that's doing that and telling you by the clock exactly what the costs are to make the T-shirt for me to buy it for $45.
Just to the gentleman's point about slow fashion, is that an oxymoron?
Well, no. I mean, I think that you can take it from two different standpoints. Slow fashion can refer to the idea of going back to the hand, of the slow process behind making a garment or making a collection. On the other hand, you could look at it simply in terms of consumption. So fast fashion is, as you said, speeding a garment from the design room to the shop floor in sometimes as little as a week, but sometimes 2 days. People can do that.
Wow.
So that's the fast end. The slow end is about literally slowing down that pattern of consumption and saying, okay, we're, it's actually winding the clock back to seasonal drops. Now, will the consumer accept that? That's a question. That's a question for you and for us. But, you know, slowing down the consumption of fast fashion. And that is something that the more I find out about this area, I've been working in it for about 5 years, the more I'm feeling that actually I don't want any more stuff. I think that we are actually coming to a place of fast fashion fatigue. I think that I'm not alone when I say that when I look at all the stuff I've got in my house and my wardrobe, it makes me feel suffocated. I hate the stuff. And I, you know, what a fashion editor sitting here in the Gucci shoes in the stuff says I hate the stuff, but I feel that I'm not alone in this feeling of overwhelm that we have too much, we're consuming it too fast, and, you know, you consume too much, you get a hangover.
Okay, next question, thanks.
I'm not sure if people had seen a document at Four Corners a few weeks ago, which showed the amount of clothes that goes into landfills, which is pretty huge here. I'm just, well, wondering, in terms of the kind of profits that are being, you know, we do live in a capitalist society, which is very profit-driven, and I think fashion, in some respects, is driven by the profit motive. Now, whilst I wouldn't want to see everybody dressed in the same suits or same clothes, I think we've got to give it quite a lot of consideration. And, you know, I think good clothes certainly is worthwhile, but how do we raise consciousness of people in terms of being conscious of ecological issues? And, you know, some of the things about local manufacture is worthwhile. And how do we control, actually, you know, what is happening in China or Vietnam? We don't know whether those people are, how they are exploited. You might get one picture, but another in reality.
Okay, so that's sort of two separate questions there. On the issue, we'll come to the issue of how do we know. We'll come to that first of all. But the question about raising consciousness, we sort of touched on this a little bit at the beginning, didn't we? I mean, saying that it's not, in your view, Claire, it's not necessarily widespread. So, but as a panel, how would you think that consciousness could be changed and short of another Rana Plaza collapse? Who wants to have a go?
I mean, I don't want to. I would just say that even though I think that we are taking the first steps, I think that there is also plenty of evidence to see that people are consuming from a more value-driven standpoint. And you see that. So conscious consumerism is the phrase, but people are looking for stories that make them feel good behind the products that they buy, and that is happening. So it's not all doom and gloom. I think we are going that way.
And it can come from the manufacturers themselves, can't it? Sort of as a selling point, and, you know, as they're searching for the ever more elusive USP, be.
And that's what the Everlane are a really great example of this. You know, they're millennials who set it up, aren't they? I mean, they're young, a younger generation, guys in their 20s. I think they had like a Silicon Valley background. They're real, they're entrepreneurs who didn't know anything about fashion, but they've applied that kind of really innovative business model thinking to fashion. And the, radical transparency. So it's like, why wouldn't we tell our customer every single, you know, detail of how the costs break down? And there is much more of a growing interest amongst, you know, global consumers. We've become so self-determined, I think, when you talk about in consumer behaviour terms. We're so, you know, highly, you know, playing out our own self-identities through how we consume. And I think there is a reaction now. There's a backlash. We're not interested anymore in accepting what... You've also got to understand the textile and fashion industry, you know, was founded on the Industrial Revolution. It comes out of the kind of 19th and 20th century industrial capitalist model, which was, you know, invented mass manufacturing. So of all the manufacturing sectors, fashion really represents this. And it's, in some ways, it's been the slowest to respond. You know, like the consumer goods, you know, market, like the printers and TVs, and that all of the manufacturers of those have been much quicker to respond to, you know, their producer responsibilities.
Right.
But fashion is now finally
But is that
up.
Just the case amongst the good burgers of Fitzroy and Carlton, or is it actually the case everywhere else where people can't afford to spend $60 on a T-shirt? Is that, you know... Are we sort of preaching
reference.
To the converted here, or is it you know, is there actually a rising consciousness amongst the people who go to Kmart? I buy my kids' clothes at Kmart because I can't afford to buy, you know, well, I don't even know what Seeds practices are. Like, it's just I can't afford $30 for a T-shirt for my 9 month old who's just going to stain it within a, you know, 2 days. Is there if we talk about rising consciousness? Is that happening? Is that filtering down everywhere? And if not, what could change?
There was the recent study by Nielsen, actually, that suggested that I think it was 73% of millennials are willing to pay more for a sustainable brand. So I think that is changing. And when we were researching and starting Not My Style, we went and spoke to a lot of the brands, and the brands were telling us consumers don't care. And I used to get so frustrated in these meetings because I was like, they do. They don't have information to care about. They don't know. They don't understand. And it is so... deliberately opaque when I went digging to try and find the information. So if I'm proactively doing it and I'm creating an app for consumers and I'm finding it hard, well, how hard is it for someone who might not have that time or interest or background in sustainability?
Okay, so that's the second part of the question. How hard is it to find out about the transparency and the sourcing and the manufacturing
It's getting better. So I think one of the things that I would just briefly comment on, and we've spoken a little bit about H&M, and H&M get thrown under the bus a bit, in my opinion, as do Gap and a whole heap of other companies that are doing really great proactive things to make changes. You know who I want you to throw under the bus? The ones that say nothing. So the way we rate apps, stores on Not My Style, is we have this selection criteria of 22 pieces, and we go on their websites. We don't ask them for the information. It has to be public facing materials. And there are so many brands. I can give you a couple: French Connection, Ralph Lauren. I could not find one piece of information across their entire website about their supply chain. Throw them under the bus. Go and talk to them about what's happening behind closed doors, because consumers deserve to know. And I think there's increasing understanding, and brands are getting so much better. Even in the time we launched all the ratings, and we went to the brands before we went public and we said, here it is, this is what we're doing, this is your rating, sorry, or yay, and we're going to be launching in a couple of months. Well, the brands came back to us and said, our website's just been updated.
Oh, really?
We want that to happen. We want brands to be sharing more. So for us, if we helped them get to that point where they said, okay, before this app goes live, let's get some information up there, then that's great, because it means that we have access to the information to make informed decisions. And I would just say, on the consumer movement thing, one of my favourite things to look at, and you guys might know more about this than me, is food. So dolphin-free tuna. That was a consumer movement. People got all up in arms when they thought there was dolphin in their tuna, and that changed really rapidly. Cage-free eggs. They're not really even on supermarket shelves anymore, caged eggs. These things can change, but they happen incrementally. Consumer behaviour is a really, really tough one, especially one that really reflects our own identity. But I reckon it's happening. It's happening.
All right, next question, please. Thanks.
Thanks. So I think earlier this year, that there was a parliamentary inquiry, which is still going on, into modern slavery and working conditions in supply chains. Mm-hmm. I think some companies like Adidas and David Jones voiced their support, and there's been a commitment from the government that there'll be reporting requirements next year that are mandated on, I think, companies with over $100 million. I just wanted to get your thoughts, or get the thoughts of the panel, on what impact that'll have on the Clean Clothes campaign, and I guess what is the role of government in this issue at all?
Okay, do you want?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really good focus for the government to have. I mean, we have a number of focuses we already have to adhere to, such as packaging covenants and all of those things, which are driving really great recycling behaviour as well. And, you know, every 12 months we obviously need to report on that, and what are we doing to reduce the packaging that comes through our entire business. So it's not only the supply chain, it can be in our stores, it can also be just in our basic office spaces as well. So I think that's driven some fantastic behaviour. And it keeps in the business, that conversation continually ticking along. So I think there's no doubt we choose to pay a living wage. Some companies pay whatever the standard wage conditions are, but we choose to pay above that, which is called a living wage, to actually enable people to actually support themselves within that current, whatever market is that they're actually working in. So I think, I do think that government regulation is a really good thing, and I think that it just keeps all of us, you know, having those conversations and continuing to talk about it. So yeah, I do fully support it. I don't know what the other guys think, but
I do. So I've just moved back from London, and in the UK, the Modern Slavery Bill came in last year or whenever it was. And I think what's interesting about it, so to adhere to the bill, you essentially have to have a statement on your website that says what you're doing around supply chains and human trafficking. So that in itself is not a ton, but it has to be signed off by your board. So you have to go and have these really proactive conversations around what are we going to say in our statement, and any good board is going to say, well, what are we actually doing? So it's a really good step in the right direction. I think we'll see a lot of change, and I hope that it works this way in Australia, that this is the beginning of a much broader conversation to influence how these things happen.
Mm-hmm. Just talking about the kind of government sort of regulation issue, I think especially, you know, one of my interests is the sort of textile recycling and landfill issue. And, you know, in terms of that, I think in Australia it's going to be needed, and I think it's really important, because this is, you know, this is a wicked problem, and you know as they say, you can't solve a wicked problem just through one solution. It's going to require all stakeholders to get involved, and just, you know, the idea of textile recycling is going to require changes to, you know, how much tax does a waste management company pay when they dump stuff in landfill. You know, we really need to see.
So government intervention has to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say exactly the same thing, that we know that we cannot have change simply by consumer pressure. Brands won't make the change on their own. Yeah. We need government regulation across the board for this stuff. I'm now obsessed with the pricing carbon. I think we need the government to step in and say, our job is to actually regulate some of this stuff that is trashing the environment and trashing people and planet.
I'm really into that. Okay, next question, please.
I've got questions and a comment, and I would just like to say that I've been in this industry probably for longer than most of you have been on the planet, but anyway, having said that, I'm not really seeing what you're saying in terms of quality. I'd like to see us go back to when there was real quality, because I'm still not seeing it. I've been here 20 years, and I've yet to see very much in the way of quality fashion.
From a production point of view,
all points of view.
Mm-hmm.
The fabrics are not good quality, most of them. There are some. There's a couple of brands that I really, really like, but they don't make anything in my size. They're for young people. I'm not young, as you may have guessed. But the other thing is, I'm not seeing the quality in the styling, not like it used to be. I'm not seeing the quality in the fabric. And I'm just not seeing that, you know, people don't seem to care about the clothes. And I would like to see people care a little bit more about the clothes. You go into a shop, the clothes on the racks are all wrinkled. They're not even handled with care. So you kind of think, I haven't bought anything for years. I go shopping a lot. I don't buy anything, because the quality is not there. I'm used to a better quality than that. So I'm going to challenge you on that one. But the other thing I'd like to say too is that a lot of this does come down to, like, I really think that every time I come to one of these events, and I do come to a lot of them, I've got your book, Claire, and I think it's delightful, but I do think we're speaking to the converted, and we need to have a bigger movement, and we need to reach more people. This kind of a talk needs to be in an auditorium with thousands, not the few of
us. I'm sure the Wheeler Centre would absolutely love to have an auditorium with thousands.
That's what we need.
And what was your question, Matt?
Change. Now, the question is, if you continue to manufacture offshore, I would actually like to see some of the manufacturing coming back here. And I know that's you know, people are just going to balk at that. I have $60 T-shirts in my wardrobe that I bought 20 years ago, and I'm still wearing them. And I've got lots of clothes like that. And as I said, I haven't bought anything for years. So I want to know what you have in mind for, and for people my age, there are no clothes. I'm starting my own label because I can't find anything to wear. And so I want to know what you think is going to change the attitude that people that are older don't care about these things, because I'm finding that a lot. Everybody keeps saying, oh, the young people are right in this and they all care. I'm not seeing anybody or hearing anyone say that the older people care as well, and we do. And so my question to you is, do you have any interest at all in the fashion industry that caters for older women in particular? Because there is very little of quality out there.
I mean, there are brands that do market themselves as being for older people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not too sure in relation, I don't know whether Jess is aware of any that manufacture in Australia, but there's definitely a number of brands that do definitely cater for a different segment, and I think they have a higher price point and certainly have, you know, that fabrication as well that would suit that as well. So in terms of Australian manufacturing, I'm not sure. I know there's been a number of high street brands that have gone after things like whether it's Jeans West actually buying Australian merino and actually putting that into their garments and having that sourcing right through. I think there's certainly some brands doing that. In terms of manufacturing, I'm sure there are some quite small brands out there that would absolutely be manufacturing in Australia. So I'm sure they would be there. Jess, I'm not too sure if you've heard of any.
Find any, I'm have sorry you? To say
okay.
to you.
Okay,
so,
okay.
And I do know how to research.
So sure, okay.
I'd like to know if there are any, because I haven't found any yet that are, I've found brands that are good, that manufacture well and do good design,
yeah,
but they don't make anything that's appropriate for someone my age.
Sure,
either the dresses
okay.
are too short or they're yeah. just too tight, you know,
yeah.
they're not sized properly.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about, and the industry needs to start doing something
sure.
about that as well.
Yeah,
I think on your question, I've heard that expressed before, and it's a really good point. I've worked in magazines for 20 years, and often I've had readers' letters, or we've heard from readers who are saying that in an older segment of the market, they're not being spoken to as much as they want to be. And mm-hmm. that, to me, is definitely a great opportunity for designers out there, because we do need to be embracing all aspects of the market. And fashion's not only for 20-year-olds, let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's a great opportunity there for
local designers.
Well,
you're starting your own label, so we look forward to... Does it have a name yet? You can get some free advertising. Okay. All right. Well, maybe next time. All right. Yes, please. Next question.
Hi. I worked on the Ethical Fashion Initiative earlier this year, and I helped work on our source map, which basically locates where things are made and comes down to where a buckle's made, and you can see exactly the location that it's made. We know that manufacturing is closing in China and a lot of it is moving to Africa. So I would like to know from a brand point of view how, brands can locate that third party, maybe in terms of a transparency point of view. If you were still working with someone in China, how do you know they're not outsourcing to somewhere like Africa where maybe...
So you're saying that it's effectively being subcontracted
yeah.
without the knowledge of...
Yeah, well, how do
of the companies
know,
yeah. to... Okay.
Yeah, yeah, they know it's getting subcontracted, but what to wear is...
Yeah, right? It's yeah. a really good question, because yeah. that is absolutely a really key element that you do have to be across. So for us, we have people on the ground in the markets where we manufacture, and they are actually out in the factories all the time. So they're actually seeing our garments go through the factory, and so they actually know exactly where those garments are being produced.
So you directly employ... spotters, effectively.
Correct.
Inspectors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, basically production people who are
and
actually...
And how common is that amongst the big brands?
Look, I honestly couldn't say. I know certainly there are challenges in... There are factories that absolutely do subcontract, and so it is absolutely a key issue that if you don't know where your garments are being produced, they could be offshore somewhere else or sourced in... a factory that's not as ethical as the one that you actually think is getting produced in. So you do really need to have those people on the ground,
but
and
just,
you do need to be following.
I just want to go back to the questioner, actually, because I have, in a former life, I actually reported from a garment factory in Lesotho, which is a little country inside South Africa, and it was supported by the American government, and these... were the only jobs going around for lots of women there. And they were actually very important sources of revenue for that country. And there was an act called the AGOA, which was a big thing in America, which is basically trying to help Africa through anything other than arms manufacture. And so my question to you is, are you saying that that's necessarily a bad thing, that's outsourced to the African continent, or why are you asking that question?
No, absolutely not. A lot of the projects that the Ethical Fashion Initiative works on is by connecting artisans with fabulous brands like Stella McCartney and Mimco in Australia. There's several more. The good thing about the EFI is that they have their own system of impact assessment, so you can, you know, it's on a holistic level looking at the sustainability and the ethics of how everything's produced and it's all traced. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing. I suppose if the exact same model that's been used in China for decades now in terms of the level of exploitation, the level of environmental impact, if that's just moved straight to countries in Africa, then that's not a good thing.
But is that based on evidence of that, or are you just questioning whether that's the case?
There are countries that are already, that exist in different countries.
There's a big nervousness about the shift to Africa from a regulatory perspective as well. And just on the locally made thing, you know, great if things can be Australian made, but we can't discount the wonder that the garment sector has done for China, Cambodia, Bangladesh in bringing jobs to people that really didn't have them, which is what you can hope happens in Africa if it's done well.
For a lot of developing countries or developing economies, the manufacturing sector is the entry level to them developing, to them sort of, you know, being able to have infrastructure and roads and develop education and hospitals. So it's...
I mean, globally, the garment industry employs, is it 60 or...
I think it's 70 to 80% women. Is that what you're going to say?
Oh, no, I was going to say...
I thought it was 40 million.
60 million.
Oh, the number. Oh, I think it's 60.
It's an enormous employer. And
mainly
as,
women,
Mainly women aged between 18 and 24, most with children. The garment industry globally, we need it. It has been a huge source of income and economic growth and prosperity in all of the territories in which it has boomed. There are 4 million garment workers in Bangladesh, which is the second largest producer of clothing now, and certainly as wages go up, then brands do chase the cheapest needle, as we say, but look for cheaper alternatives. And I think that's where the kind of fear that when the garment industry moves in search of cheaper labour in Africa, that's where that fear comes in, because obviously in less sophisticated territories, regulation is less advanced. But the questioner asked about, was saying that she worked with the Ethical Fashion Initiative. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing organisation. They are under the aegis of the United Nations and they're non-for-profit. And what they do is hook up artisanal micro-producers in places like Kenya, Ghana, Burkina Faso, with big fashion mostly in Europe, like Vivienne Westwood, and here with Mimco. So there are organisations out there that are trustworthy, that are doing wonderful work to bring better practices into these places. So there is a lot of hope in this space, as well as the grim stuff, I suppose.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yes, down the front, thanks. We've got 6 minutes left, guys. So get your questions in if you've got any more. We'll try and rattle through a few.
I just wondered if anybody's across any technology where millennials are buying clothes on the internet rather than going into a store and taking a whole lot of garments into the change room to try on. And older people are also going with fashion brands that supply a magazine at home, and once you get the idea of what your size is, you can order them and have them delivered to your house, and that's usually a good quality. So people are tending to not wanting to go into retail. I just wonder, is there any technology out there that you've seen using 3D technology or such that I can go into a change room and select a type of clothing and have it clothe me electronically, so to speak?
That's not really an ethical fashion question.
But ethically, as far as we mass manufacture and throw away half the stuff, TK Maxx and Marshalls.
You'd rather buy something that fits you perfectly, that you're going to keep for years.
It'll get to a point of we're only manufacturing by order. It will electronically go to the sewer who will sew it, and the lady who can't get a skirt the right length or whatever else, it it will adjust the length for her.
Yeah, so fabulous. And it could be one of the solutions to our fashion waste problem. And there's a very interesting woman at RMIT called Kate Kennedy who's doing great work in this area of body mapping. And that is about bringing bespoke out of the luxury space into the world where we can all access it en masse.
Wow.
So actually that technology could save us.
That was a very ethical fashion question. I completely take that back. Well done.
But that's also, there's a brand in Sydney called Citizen Wolf who, you know, Claire and I love, and that's, they're not using a kind of 3D technology, but their customer is willing to pay a little bit more for a good t-shirt out of a really lovely merino wool or a good organic cotton, and you basically go into their shop, you try on a kind of a prototype of the t-shirt, you take the t-shirt home and you take a sort of order form home and you do some measuring at home and you basically, you know, give your own measurements and then you send it back via an app and then they basically produce it and they post it to you. And it's a really growing
Citizen Wolf
idea.
Citizen
Wolf is the name of the company.
And I should say as well, if anybody has any further questions, because I'll try and cover off before we end just some basic places where the panel suggests that you can go if you want to try and buy more ethically, not necessarily in terms of shop names, but in terms of organisations that can direct you towards that. But everyone here, I think, is on Twitter as well. So just go to the Wheeler Centre Twitter page and they will have everyone. And I'm sure that the women here would be more than happy to help. Did somebody else want to pick up on that, or can I go to one more?
I was just going to say there's some really great technology that's coming through. We're seeing a lot of people coming to visit us that actually do all of that body mapping with the technology, and so again we can basically upload all of our measurements of every garment that we have in the business, and you could absolutely then map your body and actually know exactly which garments we have in our range that would actually suit you. So we're seeing a lot of people bringing that technology to us, so I think that's not very far away. And then I think the next element, I think Birds of Prey have also recently, they are actually now, they've closed their stores in America. They actually, that's the shoe retailer where you pre-order shoes, specially made, bespoke shoes. They've actually closed their stores in America and you actually order online and they get shipped straight from China for you in about 10 days. So that is all coming fairly soon, I would say, not far away. Exactly. Well, you know what's so bizarre is there is no Australian standards on sizing. So I just think that is so incredible for women to actually, it's so frustrating, I know.
Let's just say one final question and then we'll have to wrap up. Yes, down the back, thanks.
So my question is more about media. What role does the media have to encourage or support consumer accountability? Like, I would love to open up a magazine and know the grading of the product that you're spruiking or you're promoting. That would be really interesting.
I think that's one for the fashion editor at large of Murray Clark.
I can't answer this from a Marie Claire perspective because I do, as you know, write about ethical fashion from my own perspective, so this isn't an official answer from my day job. But I do think that the media has an enormous role to play when it comes to education, obviously less so when it comes to monthly glossy fashion magazines, which do a different job to the job that is done by newspapers or news websites. Generally speaking, your monthly glossy fashion magazine was designed and created and thought of in the first place to sell you a fantasy of art-based wonderment that would make you certainly buy clothes. But look at the history of Vogue. It was also about transporting you with beautiful photographs, giving you something delicious to dream about. Are we in the space of investigating the fast fashion supply chains? No, we're not. You would probably go to The Guardian or The Age for that. Do I think that it would be nice to open a magazine and see more stuff about the supply chain of each of the garments contained in each shoot? Yes. Is it going to happen? Nope.
Really? There would be no appetite for that amongst the fashion media in general?
There'd be no appetite amongst advertisers who pay for magazines to exist.
Right.
And that's just a reality. Maybe there could be. Yeah. Maybe in the future that is what brands will be asking for. I don't know. Why don't we ask Suzanne? Would they be into that?
Yeah, look,
if you were booking an ad, would you be more inclined to book it if I said to you, we're going to be radically transparent with each photograph?
Possibly not with an actual ad, but I guess it's that advertorial type component where I think as well, as I said earlier, we do need to be accountable, but then at the end of the day, we possibly also don't talk about our message enough to the public either in terms of what we are actually doing.
Sure.
And I think it's an opportunity potentially for some of us to talk a little bit more about it, because as I said earlier, for me it was a whole new world going into these factories and seeing these amazing entrepreneurs and amazing workers doing beautiful garments and actually not really having seen how amazing all of that process is, but it's also quite a minefield for customers who have no access to that.
Yeah.
And that's an awesome ad, if I may, around Black Friday last year by Patagonia, who, if you guys don't know, is doing super great ethical stuff. And it was a picture of one of their jackets and it said, "Don't buy this jacket." And it was essentially kind of preaching about fast fashion, saying essentially you don't need to buy more and you don't need to be doing these types of things for Black Friday. So maybe there is a tiny, tiny little place, but their brand is encompassed in that message. So it's very difficult for any other brands to kind of reach that point as well.
All right, we've run out of time. So just super fast, if you had to give each one of you a suggestion about where people could go if they wanted to be more ethically minded in the clothes that they bought, a resource that you would recommend, Jess?
So obviously not my style, it would be great, but it's not in Australia. But there is an awesome app called Good On You, which does a very similar thing. So go there, take a look. They rate a whole heap of Australian brands and make some ethical choices.
Rebecca?
Look, I'll have to go with the girls' expertise on this one, so I'm happy to actually be guided by them. But certainly, yeah, I think it's a really good space and we definitely need to get some better messaging out there. I think as a retailer, I can certainly take that on board.
Okay.
I'd say go into your wardrobes. Yeah. Go and look at what you've already got and really care for it and, you know, learn to look after it and hand wash it and repair it. And also go to Vinnie's. Yeah. More.
I think I'm going to say go to Instagram, because actually it's a good source of information. If you just tap in, I do it all the time, # sustainable fashion or # organic cotton, you can actually discover lots of particularly smaller and independent younger designer brands that way, and I find that really cool.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. All right, we've run out of time. I just want to thank all of the panel. Rebecca, thank you again for stumping up and being the the one retailer here. Awesome. We've got Jessica, Rebecca, Claire and Clara. Well done.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.